Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 597, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This has been recorded on May 13th of the year 2007. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, the successor volume to another book we've discussed by Ed, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus. Ed, welcome once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
We have been talking about a remarkably complex series of associations in New Orleans, which has brought some of the finest and most prestigious medical minds in the United States, people like Dr. Mary Sherman and the late Dr. Alton Ochsner, into contact with an extreme right-wing, not only an extreme right-wing political milieu, but also a covert action milieu, people involved in clandestine warfare, and a virus, the SV40 virus, which contaminated the polio vaccine and perhaps some other vaccines, and which causes cancer. It's extremely oncogenic in human beings, among other animals. This virus made its way into the polio vaccine, and it appears that attempts at irradiating those viruses in order to come up with a cancer epidemic was mutated, pun intended, to using mutated monkey virus to create a biological weapon to kill Fidel Castro. And it is in the context of this right-wing political milieu, extreme right-wing political milieu, and a covert action directed at Castro and Cuba that we find players like Lee Harvey Oswald, Judith Vary Baker, and people like David Ferry and the aforementioned Drs. Ochsner and Sherman all operating together in a secret medical laboratory. And that secret medical laboratory is the focal point of your book. How's that for a synopsis of what one cannot synopsize in?
Well, that's part of the issue. What I want to do right now is I want to retrace that a little bit so that people understand some of the key steps in the process, because it's not clear how all that fits together.
Sure.
Let me go back and start with polio. When they went to make the polio vaccine, they had to grow a lot of the polio virus, and they discovered that the polio virus, which many people believe originally came from monkeys in the first place, grew very well on the kidneys of the rhesus monkey, which is the monkey that's got the blood that is most similar to the human blood. And so when they went to produce that large volume of polio vaccine, they literally killed the monkeys, cut out their kidneys, grew the polio virus on their kidney cells, and then took out the polio virus to make the polio vaccine. But at the time, the technology was not as sophisticated as it is today, and they wound up taking out a whole bunch of other monkey viruses at the same time. And in the 1950s, they did not really know what the consequences of these viruses were. And in particular, they didn't think that viruses could cause cancer. And so if they didn't cause other diseases within the short term, they pretty much ignored them, because there are many benign viruses out there. A virus doesn't automatically cause disease. And so they released the hundreds of millions of doses of the polio vaccine, knowing that they had a whole bunch of other viruses in there that they didn't quite understand, but they weren't terribly concerned about them. After they had released about 200 million doses of the polio vaccine, then they discovered that one of the viruses in there, SV40, was a cancer-causing virus. And this is clearly documented. I mean, it's on the front page of NCI, National Cancer Institute newsletters and stuff. There's argument over, you know, all the stuff that the government doesn't want to admit to. But there's no argument over whether there were dozens of monkey viruses piggybacking into the polio vaccine. That's how they get in there in the first place. Once they realize that they are looking at a real cancer-causing virus in 100, 200 million doses of the polio vaccine, they understand the political consequences of this. I mean, this is the biggest mistake in history, okay? And nobody wants to be held accountable for it. And we're talking about during the years of the Eisenhower administration when Richard Nixon was vice president, okay? And so what happens is they start a medical Manhattan project to try to rapidly develop a anti-cancer vaccine that can be used to stop what they're looking at as being an epidemic of cancer. And they want to do this quickly and quietly. And so they stamp everything secret and they start this operation. And this is how these very talented, very well-respected, very connected people get into this operation originally. Dr. Alt Noschner, who's one of the most credentialed and respected people in American medicine. He was president of the American Cancer Society. He got the Distinguished Service Award from the American Medical Association. He's president of all kinds of organizations. And he brings in Mary Sherman, who is a profoundly respected cancer expert. She's an orthopedist by training, but she's a pathologist, and she's very into bone cancers and all that, and particularly the use of radiation on bone cancers. And so the initial phase of this thing, I believe, was that the linear particle accelerator was set up with millions and millions of dollars of laundered U.S. government money. It was on U.S. government property. It was top secret because nobody wanted to admit what they were doing or why they were doing it. What they were doing was very dangerous, because they were messing around with the DNA of deadly viruses. And nobody wanted to explain why they were roasting viruses with radiation because they had contaminated the polio vaccine. Now, while this is going on in the foreground, the background event is that Castro takes over Cuba. And there's this belief in New Orleans that Castro is going to start World War III and nuke New Orleans. And the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62 really makes this a fear of reality instead of a fear of bad imagination. And the argument, which looks a little weak in hindsight, but it was very real at the time, was that if you could get rid of this one man, Fidel Castro, you could prevent World War III. So that's a justification to start doing stuff. And the logic of this plot in New Orleans to kill Castro was that Kennedy didn't want anything that was overtly traceable back to the White House to be involved in killing Castro. So the charm of the cancer weapon, the bioweapon, was it would look like it was natural causes. But they had to get the bioweapon into Cuba. And that was Oswald's role in this plot. I want to emphasize something here, if I can. To me, I never wanted this to be a JFK book. I never wanted to get involved in all those arguments about Oswald and everything else. Mm-hmm. I tried to sort of tiptoe past all that in my first book. But, you know, this story leads where this story leads. And the evidence and the witnesses, particularly Judith, says very clearly that Lee Oswald and Mary Sherman knew each other, and they were both involved in this. And there's other books that have come out recently, like Joan Mellon's book, which places Oswald in the apartment across the hall from Mary Sherman's on a regular basis. And there are a lot of connections there. Or to put it bluntly, 40 years after Jim Garrison originally announced the discovery of the Ferry Sherman Laboratory in Playboy magazine, we're finally getting to understand something about what he was talking about.
If I can very briefly jump in, Ed, understand that not only was this program to utilize these mutated viruses to create a weapon to kill Castro going on, which basically you have some of the finest medical people in the world placing their expertise, to a certain extent at least, at the disposal of an ultra-right-wing I would say, fascist political milieu. But also, it's one something to understand is that, according to a number of people, and for example, Anthony Summers in his book Conspiracy, has pointed out that the Kennedy White House was taking a different approach to Castro's Cuba, and that he was seeking to woo Castro away from the Soviet Union and was making backdoor diplomatic approaches to Castro even on the day that he was killed. The reason I bring this up in the context of what we're going to talk about, Ed, in your book, was that this was a political milieu which not only had access to these deadly bioagents, but which was at that time departing from official U.S. policy and basically going rogue and under the circumstances. And rogue perhaps belongs in quotes, because the rogues are the most powerful people in the country.
Well, and they're not all the same group of people. You had Dave Talbot, who was the editor-in-chief of Salon.com, has just released a book called Brothers, where he talks a lot about Bobby Kennedy's reaction to all this, to the Kennedy assassination, etc. That book and others point out that Bobby was running his own operation, independent of the CIA, out of his office, where he had his own assets, and all this stuff was extremely secret, even to the other members of government, because right? He didn't want to tell people like the FBI what he was doing, or the CIA. And some of the other people, the CIA people who may not even have still been CIA people, had connections with the mafia. So you wind up with these Crimea type organizations that are part intelligence and part mafia, but you're not really sure who they're reporting to, mm-hmm. because there's no paper trail back to like the director of the CIA. So are they being run by other people who are even supra to the CIA in the power structure, who have their hands on the levers of power? I mean, that's what all this stuff begs the question of. But what I'm trying to focus on is the fact that we now have an understanding and an explanation of what happened in New Orleans with this biological weapon, this underground medical laboratory, and the involvement of Oswald, which we had some suspicions of before, but now we've got live witness testimony about his involvement of it. And Judith's take on this, by the way, is she talked to Lee on Wednesday before the assassination. So we're talking here November 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And he told her at the time that there was going to be a real attempt to kill Kennedy on Friday, and then it was going to happen either at the Love Field, at Daley Plaza, or at the International Trade Mart. And he had somehow penetrated that, and he was going to stay in position till it was all over, because he basically couldn't get out alive. But he was not the guy doing the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty clear that he obviously gets murdered before the week is out. But one of the questions I've always had was, you know, why the heck wasn't he protected better? I mean, why hadn't Bobby Kennedy sent people in to protect him, or at least to make sure that things were done legally and properly? But Kennedy didn't. He choked for some reason. And is that relationship in part because Bobby Kennedy knew who Oswald was and knew what he was involved in, and he didn't want to get him into court and start talking about the bioweapon any more than the CIA or the mob did?
Mm-hmm.
So when you start to realize how many people were really plugged into this thing from different points of view, you can see how convenient the idea of Lone Nut was. I mean, they could all say, well, let's just agree this guy's a lone nut and we'll just, you know, go on about our business.
Yeah, Oswald was not a nut, and he wasn't a lone anything. He was certainly working for at least one, I suspect more than one faction of the U.S. government, and it appears that at least one of those doubled back on him. We should recall, too, in the context of Lee Oswald, that while Oswald was in the Soviet Union, there were people using his name and setting up a legend, so to speak, of him as a firearms expert. So somebody certainly had something in mind. But coming back to your story, Ed, in New Orleans, and coming back to what you've uncovered on top of what we talked about in FTR 19, again, the three-hour interview that we did in June of 96, you've actually got specifically Lee Oswald and Mary Sherman and David Ferry and Alton Ochsner all working together consciously on these mutated monkey viruses in order to create a biological weapon that would kill Fidel Castro.
And mm-hmm. Judith Baker, because it's Judith Very Baker,
right,
who is the technician who is actually doing the laboratory work for this constellation of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that they, once they have... What they're doing is they're taking tumors out of mice, and they're looking for the most aggressive tumors, and then they grind them up and they send them back to the radiation lab, where they're exposed to more radiation. They're reinjected into mice, and then they get the ones that grow the fastest, and so they're on a feedback loop to try to find the most aggressive cancers. And Judith is the one doing the work in David Ferry's apartment, and Lee is running her around and running the resources around between these various laboratories, including the laboratory across the street from Ferry's apartment that I wrote about in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to a point where things are looking good from their point of view, that the cancer is extremely aggressive. They try it on some monkeys, they kill all those monkeys, and then they're left with the question, is, does this really work on a human? And so they get a prisoner from Angola Penitentiary sent over to the mental hospital in Jackson. They drive up to the mental hospital and inject this guy with the cancer to test the effectiveness of the bioweapon. Now, we're talking about human experimentation with lethal cancers. They kill this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Judith gets very upset about this. I mean, she's 19 years old at the time. She's, you know, the idea of actually killing real people is kind of new to her. And she writes a letter of protest to Ochsner, and she, you know, violates the secrecy of the organization by putting something like that down on paper. And Ochsner just, you know, he's furious and reneges on all the promises he made to her and threatens her and Lee and all that other stuff. But that is what was happening in that trip to Clinton. It wasn't to try to portray Oswald as, you know, as any patsy or anything. He went up as part of the team, and Clay Shaw drove them up. And so when you look at, we're all familiar with Jim Garrison's JFK movie, okay? What's really going on in that movie is what happened to Jim Garrison when he tried to investigate Lee Harvey Oswald, and mm-hmm. particularly when he got his hands on Clay Shaw. And Shaw what's Shaw going to do? Turn around and say, yeah, I knew Lee Oswald. We were developing this biological weapon. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, nobody wanted Shaw to say that. The CIA didn't want him to say that. And Shaw's, Shaw was the head of the trademark in New Orleans. Everybody that was in the business community in New Orleans knew that everybody involved in international trade was filing reports to the CIA on their travels.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's a normal yeoman's routine. And Shaw was at the center of that, and he was collecting those things. But he apparently was involved in these other things because he was with Oswald on a fairly regular basis in New Orleans and drove Oswald and Ferry and Judith up to Jackson for them to inject this prisoner with that. And they got up there, and the prisoner wasn't there yet, so they hung out in Clinton and killed time there, which explains that episode and the thing. So for the first time, we have a real insider who is willing to say what happened on that. And that's the value of Judith Very Baker's testimony.
Yeah, and one of the things that you do in the closing parts of your book, Ed, is you sit down and you interview Judith Very Baker, and you ask her about how many people knew about this secret laboratory. Again, the laboratory originally to research how to perhaps make a vaccine to cure the cancer contaminant in the polio vaccine, and then ultimately to take those mutated monkey viruses and kill Fidel Castro. And you asked Judith Vary, and she says, yep, Oswald knew about it. He was working on it. Mary Sherman knew about it. What she did was to tie in the various people that you've introduced on the stage and to say, yes, in fact, they not only knew one another, they were all working together on the same project, and they were fully conscious of what they were doing.
Right. And how did I meet Judith Vary Baker? She was brought to me by 60 Minutes.
Who then didn't go with the story.
That's right. But they spent a lot of time and money looking into the story. And I'm not sure exactly what happened there, but it's pretty clear to me that they knew that there were... This is a really interesting point. One of the things that Judith has been accused of is reading my book and mm-hmm. then writing herself into it.
Yep.
Now, I will say that my book is an obscure little book that I haven't even sold 3,000 copies of, I mean, in terms of Mary Vary and the monkey virus, okay? At the moment that 60 Minutes was working on Judith's story, and they spent a lot of time with her, okay, she was getting ready to be internationally famous to millions and millions and millions of people through the power of the microphone of 60 Minutes. If she had thrown Lee under the bus, if she had told them, yeah, Lee told me on Wednesday he was going to kill that son of a bitch Kennedy, okay, I think they would have aired her story. The problem was she didn't support that, and she said the issue here is the bioweapon. And they couldn't run the story about Oswald's girlfriend without getting into the biological weapon. And that is what killed the story on Judith. But they were nice enough to introduce me to her.
Mm-hmm. And the story of how 60 Minutes laboriously researched Judith Vary Baker's situation, how 60 Minutes came to be the vehicle for introducing you to the witness who would confirm the many hypotheses that you'd been exploring and sort of twisting them all into one common piece of thread. Basically, that's set forth at great length in your book. And well, one of the things that's striking, too, is that I did not know until I'd read Dr. Mary's Monkey, and that was the extent to which the people involved with this laboratory, including Judith, including Lee Oswald, and even Dr. Mary Sherman, were privy to conversation about killing President Kennedy. Not that they were plotting to do it, but they were aware that the people with whom they were working, or at least Dr. Ochsner's wider circle and people like David Ferry, bloody well would if they didn't get rid of Castro.
It was part of what they talked about on a regular basis. Now, whether there's an operational connection between that and the people that actually pulled the trigger on Kennedy is something you cannot answer easily, but it was certainly discussed on a regular basis.
One of the other interviews that we've done about the New Orleans connections to President Kennedy's assassination, Ed, is with Bill Davey, with whose work you're very familiar, in his
right.
book Let Justice Be Done, in which we explored some of the New Orleans connections to Kennedy's assassination. And it was really quite well known that to a lot of people who had actually done the deed. One of the things that Bill Davey mentioned is that the assistant counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, in charge with investigating the New Orleans links to the assassination, identified Clay Shaw as either one of the planners of or a cutout to the planners of the assassination, thereby vindicating to a large extent Jim Garrison's investigation.
Yes, and when the House Select Committee on the Assassinations took the testimony of the town marshal in Clinton, Louisiana, who walked up to Clay Shaw's car and demanded that he produce identification, they took it in executive session so that they could keep it secret. So for 16 years, nobody knew that what Garrison had said about Clay Shaw being the guy that drove Oswald to Clinton was in fact true, and the House Select Committee on Assassinations knew it, and somebody with enough political power up there kept it secret.
Yes, indeed. Ed, one thing that you talked about in both of your books, one thing we really have only touched on, and we're down to the last 3 minutes here of our interview, but AIDS, and that too appears to be from a genetically altered monkey virus, and you theorize a bit about AIDS as well. Can you just ever so briefly touch on that before we wrap?
Well, there were lots of monkey viruses in the polio vaccine, and one of them was SIV, which is the simian immunodeficiency virus. It is the ancestor to HIV. It is the mutation of that virus that produced AIDS. And that virus was in the polio vaccine, just like SV40 was, but it's much smaller, and it traveled alongside SIV. And when they irradiated SIV, they may have very well mutated. I mean, when they irradiated the SV40 to try to make the vaccine, they could have easily irradiated SIV and mutated it. And that is one logical explanation which might possibly explain where AIDS come from. There's a couple other ones out there that I think are worth noting too, but this one needs to be on the list and needs to be seriously considered by scientists that are working on that issue so they understand what they're looking at. And I think it explains why the AIDS virus mutates as much as it does.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting aspects to the AIDS virus, including the fact that there's an inherited genetic immunity to infection by HIV, but only purebred Northern Europeans have it. No other race but the white race has it, and only purebred Northern Europeans. And given the overtly racist, frankly, and fascist nature of some of the people who were involved with this project, raises more questions than it answers under the circumstances, I think. Ed, we're down to the last couple of minutes here. Your website and how people can obtain the book.
The book is Dr. Mary's Monkey. It can be ordered from my website, which is themonkeyvirus.com. That's themonkeyvirus.com. And all the information is there. You can also go to drmarysmonkey.com, which is the publisher's website. You can order it from there. And, of course, it's on Amazon and stuff. But I would encourage you to check with the author's website, themonkeyvirus.com, first.
Okay. And again, Trine Day is the publisher of Dr. Mary's Monkey. And I would also encourage people to go to www.spitfirelist.com and to the linked websites, including the WFMU websites, which feature the various interviews that I've done with Ed over the years for free. You can download the whole thing for free, the original three-hour interview about Mary Ferry and the monkey virus, subsequent interviews. We didn't even talk about Dr. Jose Rivera in this one, but he's part of the cast of characters, and some of the interviews that I've done with Ed and other people, including Dr. Garth Nicholson, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, and Dr. Alan Cantwell back in the fall of 1996. So Dr. Mary's Monkey is the book. Themonkeyvirus.com is Ed Haslam's website. Spitfirelist.com is my website, and the many linked websites which will enable you to flesh out your understanding of what Ed is talking about. I hope we've stimulated people's curiosity here, Ed, because obviously there's an awful lot to for people to chew on. I hope that we've given them a little bit of an appetizer, whetted their appetite, and that they decide to fill their bellies.
Yes. Well, the book is clearly written and it's easily readable, even though the subject sounds pretty complicated in our radio interview. But I wrote a book for a reason, because it's the only way to present this story properly.
Amen. And it's an excellent book, and I can't encourage people strongly enough to read it, but beyond that, to then follow the evidentiary tributaries, as I like to call them, out from that to two epidemics, a soft tissue cancer epidemic and the AIDS epidemic, which are slaughtering people around the world. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 597, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This has been recorded on May 13th of the year 2007. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying, thanks for listening.